You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2009, the 16th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Montreal, Canada, from February 8th through February 11th, 2009.
Welcome. This is Bonnie Goldman, Editorial Director of The Body Pro. Right now, I'm in the poster session where researchers are standing in front of their posters. There's nothing like hearing the results of research directly from those who have actually conducted the research. It is these women and men who are transforming HIV treatment and care. In this podcast, the researchers will introduce themselves and then summarize their study. After their summary, I'll ask a few questions.
My name is Michael Campsmith, and I'm an epidemiologist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and my group is the HIV Incidence and Case Surveillance Branch, and I'm presenting at the CROI conference on an analysis of the prevalence of HIV in the United States at the end of 2006, and we're focusing on the percent of persons who are undiagnosed, have HIV infection but are undiagnosed.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find this information? I mean, if we don't know they're diagnosed, I mean, how is the...
Well, all areas are funded to collect surveillance data, and they do that at the local level, send that information without personal identifiers to the CDC. We compile national data, and then there's a statistical modeling procedure. When HIV and AIDS were first identified, we knew that HIV caused the infection, but AIDS was the end result. And so there was interest in, well, how many HIV cases would you need to result in the number of AIDS cases that you were seeing later? And that was called a back calculation model, because you just looked at the number of AIDS cases and sort of estimated backwards how many infections would have been needed years ago to result in that many AIDS cases. That was good enough until highly active antiretroviral therapies came about in the mid-1990s, which extended the period from HIV infection to AIDS on people who were taking therapy. So a back calculation strictly from AIDS data is not sufficient, not accurate enough. So now our technique is a revision or an improvement of that back calculation to be an extended back calculation, where we modeled that using HIV data from the states where it's available. And in our analysis, it was 40 out of the 50 states. D.C., District of Columbia also was not included for HIV data.
Is by the way, New York and California and Florida included?
California, no. New York and Florida, yes.
Oh, okay.
So we one of the limitations of the model is we don't have HIV data from all areas. So there is some uncertainty. People need to understand that this is an estimate. We can't directly observe this.
Right. But, and California's pretty, I mean, compared to other Missouri or something, it's pretty densely infected.
Well, California has a large population, has a large number of cases, but again, we use the statistical estimation procedure to come up with reasonable estimates of this.
So tell me a little bit about your results.
Well, the results are that overall, about 1.1 million people in the United States are estimated to be living with HIV infection, both diagnosed and undiagnosed. And of that 1.1 million, about 21% or 232,000 don't know that they're infected. They haven't been diagnosed yet. So it's about 21%.
Uh-huh. And I know over the years the number has been 1 million people are infected in the United States. Is that
this is a revision. It's an update. Uh-huh. As we gain more states contributing HIV data to our estimates, we get revisions of this. Also, over time, the number of new infections, the incidence estimates, which came out last year, show that more people are getting infected than are dying from the disease, so your prevalence or the number of people living, there is that natural escalation.
Uh-huh. And it reflects that people live a lot longer with HIV.
Yes, yes. You are having new infections every year, but people are not dying as quickly as they were earlier in the epidemic. The goal is to get people who are infected to get diagnosed, get into care, and have a prolonged life. While they do know that they're infected, you want to get them into effective prevention programs as well, so that they don't further transmit HIV.
Uh-huh. So tell me about the breakdown in ethnicity and gender.
Well, the highest percentage of cases, prevalent cases, is among African Americans. There is a differential percent for undiagnosed, where minorities, racial ethnic minorities, tend to have higher percentages of undiagnosed than whites. By risk, men who were infected heterosexually had the highest percentage undiagnosed, followed by men who have sex with men. And by age, the youngest age group, 13 to 24, had a higher percentage of undiagnosed compared to other age groups.
Uh-huh. And when you say heterosexual, so IDU, is that – how is that?
Well, there's a hierarchy of presumed transmission. So if people exhibit all the risk characteristics, we have a hierarchy that says this is – what we think is the most likely one. We can't say exactly for sure. If someone had injection drug use behavior and, let's say, was a commercial sex worker, what was the exact mode of transmission? But the hierarchy goes, if they have injection drug use and they don't also have male-to-male sexual contact, they're counted as injection drug users.
Uh-huh.
Heterosexual contact is specifically identifying heterosexual risk with someone known to have or to be at high risk for HIV infection. So for a heterosexual woman, she would identify risk of, well, I had sex with a male injection drug user, or I had sex with a bisexual male. And for heterosexual men, it would be, well, I had sex with an injection drug user, I had sex with a commercial sex worker, those sort of risks. So when we say heterosexual, it's the identification of the risk.
Uh-huh.
Injection drug users are classified, their transmission risk was injection drug use.
We used to say 250,000 people are thought to be living with HIV and they don't know it. And so the number has changed a little bit.
Well, you have an increase in the overall prevalence. So if nothing else changed, that percentage undiagnosed goes down as the overall prevalence goes up. But you also have more testing has been done through the testing initiatives. So if you take a look at the estimate previously of 250,000, our new estimate is just under 233,000. So there is both a decrease in the percentage and a decrease in the number of undiagnosed persons.
Uh-huh. So the small amount of extra HIV testing going on across the country, because even though the CDC made the recommendations in 2006,
correct,
so many states have struggled to get these testing recommendations implemented because of laws and because of just, lack of ability to...
It is a challenge. Part of it is changing the sort of mindset of HIV still being an issue. This is 30 years into the epidemic. There's burnout. It's not on the front page every day. And so there's been some sort of complacency, if you will. But we all recognize that this is a really serious problem. If you still have 21% undiagnosed, the prevalence keeps increasing. You have groups that are differentially impacted, particularly African Americans and men who have sex with men. These are areas that need focus for prevention and treatment.
I'm looking at your abstract. It says the majority of undiagnosed cases were among men who have sex with men, which is really surprising. Because you would think, given this history, you would think that they would be the community most likely to get tested and to be aware of the risk.
Early in the epidemic, there was a lot of advocacy in this group, very, very forceful for change of behaviors. But over time, some of that has decreased, not only among MSM, but among other risk categories as well. So it is a group that CDC is focused to provide testing campaigns, initiatives, that sort of thing.
Which I think over the last 8 years might have not happened, if I recall,
well,
particularly for MSM. So things might change, I guess.
The new administration has expressed that they want to have the science drive the policy, and so if the data show that certain groups need focus, the logical follow-on would be that those groups would be addressed.
Uh-huh, but it's true that it wasn't addressed for 8 years. Can you say?
I would have to say that those decisions were made at a higher level. We acknowledge at CDC that the data show that there are differences based on race, based on risk, based on age, and those need to be properly addressed.
Uh-huh. I don't know if you broke this down even further, but the percentage of MSM who are African American.
Those data are not in this poster. Poster has a limited display.
Right.
We are working on a manuscript that goes into more depth, has more breakdowns of race by risk, and so those would be addressed in that follow-on.
Uh-huh. So, because based on my understanding of the issue, I would think that the greatest percentage of MSM who do not get tested are African-American MSM.
Well, we'd have to look at the data to see that.
But
There is a large percentage of white MSM
right.
as well. There are a lot of issues with, for all MSM, but particularly for racial ethnic
right.
minorities, stigma,
right.
Lack of access to...
Homophobia.
Homophobia, stigma, right. lack of access to resources for testing, for treatment, for basic health care services, that sort of thing. So, yes, when the data come out, when the analysis comes out, we'll see what that is. But I'll have to have that come out. I can't tell you right off the top of my head which group would be differentially impacted more than others.
It's also striking, just the sentence, that whites had the lowest percentage undiagnosed, 18.8%, compared to Hispanics, African Americans, et cetera. Can you talk to that at all?
Well, again, stigma,
right?
Lack of access to care and treatment services, lack of sort of acknowledgement of risk. So there are a number of factors that are impacting that.
Uh-huh. And you have Asian and Pacific Islanders as actually the highest.
Percentage undiagnosed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So could you talk about that a little bit?
We don't get into the reasons why people don't get tested. This is uh-huh. off of surveillance data, which
right.
does not really interact with the client, ask them questions about why you did or didn't do anything. The racial ethnic minority groups, again, often have difficulty with access. For Asian Pacific Islander groups, you may have cultural and linguistic isolation. So it may be that they're just not acknowledging risk, or they don't have access to care and treatment. For that group, if you have 1% of a million, that's quite large.
Right.
If you take a look at the rates, their rates of undiagnosed infection are actually lower than whites.
Mm-hmm.
So their percentage is higher, but the population differences, again, that's a smaller population group, so their rates are actually the lowest by race ethnicity.
Are there going to be policy decisions based on this?
I'm not a policy person,
okay.
So again, we would hope that the data would drive the response. And as we've seen already with the heightened national response for African Americans, that's a group that is severely impacted, and so they are getting more focus. This is a snapshot.
Uh-huh.
CDC is committed to analyzing these data going forward. Not sure if it's going to be every year or every other year. You really need to have time pass so you can see changes that are meaningful, that we can make some sense out of.
Uh-huh. Did you also look at where in the United States seems to be most problematic?
These data are not broken down by region.
Uh-huh.
That's a little problematic. As of April 2008, all areas are reporting, but the data have not been matured. We have not been able to do some statistical adjustments, again, that account for that big influx of cases, once a state goes to name-based reporting. So it's going to be a while before we're going to be able to do any kind of regional analyses that include meaningful HIV data.
Is there anything that was really surprising about this compared to years before?
I think this reinforces things that we've seen for a while, is that MSM and racial ethnic minorities have a differential impact compared to other population groups, and that's why CDC has been committed to focusing on that through the heightened national response and some of the testing initiatives.
Uh-huh. So how did women do in this?
The percent undiagnosed is very close to the male percentage. If you start breaking that down by race by sex, we see that racial ethnic minority women have greater disparities compared to white women. And that, again, is something that's reinforcing. We've seen that in some of our other data.
What's the next step?
Again, this reinforces things that mm-hmm. have come out before. It's another piece of the puzzle to say here are groups that need focus.
Mm-hmm.
Get the initiatives, the testing in there.
Uh-huh.
People who are then diagnosed get linked to care so that we can, over time, have some effect on these data and get the numbers for all groups going in a better direction than increasing.
Uh-huh. So the people who will put out the signs that say, get tested now, that's a totally different department.
Correct. Now, what we know is that if people are diagnosed, they get into care and prevention services, most of them do reduce risk behaviors. So it follows on that as more people become diagnosed, aware of their infection, They then adapt predictive behaviors, and over time, the number of new cases can be impacted, and then over more time, the number of prevalent cases can be impacted.
Do you do the undiagnosed HIV infection prevalence like every couple of years? I haven't really seen this for a long time.
The last estimate was data from 2003. These are data from 2006. So, again, CDC is committed to doing this going forward. I can't say whether it's going to be every year, every 2 years, every 3 years, but we will be doing this as sort of updates as time goes on.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very
much.
Thank
you, Bonnie.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
Thank you for listening to this report from CROI 2009. For more coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2009.